peoples, the Mongoloid and the Negro, were left here. Then, still in the first chapter of Genesis, it records the creation of the first white race on the earth. Male and female created he them, plural now, and told them to increase and multiply and replenish the earth, refill the earth. And there, although some people to support their own theories will tell you something different and say that it referred to them as Enosh, it didn't. You look it up for yourself in your concordance, and even in the first chapter, it calls them Adam. So he created a white race. Now, there are plenty of white people in the world who are not in any way related to Israel. The other Adamites are our distant relatives, but there are whites who are not Adamites in the sense of being descendants of the Adam who shows up in the second chapter of Genesis. Now, wherever God is speaking simply of white people in general, it calls them Adam. But when it is speaking of this one particular man, the word is changed, and he is careful to say the Adam, singular. So in the second chapter of Genesis, it tells that God created this new being, the Adam. Satan has been the governor of this planet, maybe others besides, but at least the governor of this planet, and rightfully so, under appointment by God, until he forfeited his right to it by rebellion against God. Now, God didn't go to all the trouble of creating a special person to take a spade and dig up a little bit around some plants and shrubs. He had millions of Asiatics who could do that, and millions of Negroes who could have done it if they weren't too stupid. They just needed somebody to show them how. Adam was sent here to kick Satan out and take over the government of this planet as Satan's successor. Now, we're true descendants of Adam. We're as stupid as he, and we haven't learned anything in all the intervening centuries. He had our quality. He liked peace. He didn't like to make trouble. If you can just have peaceful coexistence, you know, as long as they're talking, they aren't fighting and all this stuff. So instead of kicking Satan out, he disobeyed. He made his peace with Satan, and by his own disobedience, he forfeited his right to power, the same as Satan did. We've been in trouble ever since. God saw that being his descendants and with his stupidity, we were going to have to learn the hard way, just as Adam did, so we've had our noses rubbed in it ever since. The trees in the Garden of Eden were not ordinary wooden trees such as grow in a park or a forest. There were some of those too, yes, for things to eat. But you were told of a particular tree, the tree that had knowledge of both good and evil. Can you show me any such tree in any park or forest anywhere in the world? Of course not. Then there's a place, I think it's in Jeremiah, could be Ezekiel, I could look it up if it were important, where it talks about the first Assyrian Empire, not the one that you find described at length in the Bible, invading Western Asia, but thousands of years before that. And it says the Assyrian was a mighty cedar in Lebanon, and taller than all the other trees that dwelt in his shadow and so forth. And all the trees of the Garden of God in Eden envied him. Got any tree growing in your backyard that envies anybody? This was a family tree of races and nations, and we still use that expression, you notice, a tree. Now, you'll find again reference to this in the third chapter of Genesis. Satan comes to Eve and he says, why is it true that God said, you can't eat from any of these trees in the garden here? Eve says, oh no, we can eat from all of them, except the tree which stands in the midst of the garden. God has said, ye shall not, of the fruit thereof, ye shall not eat, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. Now that is mistranslated, so it doesn't give its meaning. The word translated fruit there is the Hebrew word pirkok, and it means descendants, progeny, children, grandchildren, and so on. And the word translated touch is the Hebrew word naga, which is a more polite expression meaning to have sexual intercourse with. Do you have to be warned not to have sexual intercourse with an apple or a walnut or something of that sort? No. So you see, the Bible recognizes the existence of these other races. Adam was sent here not to mix and mongrelize with them, but to rule them with a heavy hand, because that's all they understand. Then eventually, you find, beginning in the fifth chapter of Genesis, the descendants of Adam. The Adam. Now, that is a part of the white race, there being, as we have seen, other light-complected peoples who go clear back to the first chapter of Genesis, where the Adam doesn't come into this until you get to the second chapter of Genesis. Now you'll note, following on down through the book of Genesis, in each generation from Adam down, the Bible only bothers picking out one person in that generation to trace. It mentions, and so had other sons and daughters, but it picks the one by name to carry it out. Now, God was using good biology there. If you are a breeder of dogs or goldfish or something of the sort, you know what you do. You pick only the best of each generation to breed the next. Sure, in a litter of puppies, there are one or two that they're all right to give to some family who want a pet for the children. But if you enter them in a dog show, you'd be laughed out of the dog show. That's not what you keep for breeding stock. You pick just the best, so that each generation improves over what you had before, and that's what God was doing. Now you can picture this in your mind's eye as a pyramid. The very peak top of this is Adam himself, and each generation down below him is expanding with more and more people. But one single thread runs down the center, which is the generation, the one man in each generation that God traces, so you get down to where finally he was satisfied with the result. And that was Jacob, whose name God himself changed to Israel, meaning he shall rule as God. That's a big job, you know. That's getting back to what Adam was told to do and failed. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Adamic race and their effect upon history, because that's a big thing, too. You find in the white race some variations. They're white, but they show different variations. First, you find the Nordic stocks, Teutonic, Scandinavian. They are characterized by generally considerable height. They're a tall people. A very large percentage of them are fair, though not all. You find dark hair and eyes among them, too. And an oblong, a long skull, not a round skull. Scientists classify a skull if the width from side to side is not more than 75% of the length from front to rear. They classify that as a long skull type. If the width is 80% or more, that is classified as the broad skull, the round head type, and is one of the distinguishing characteristics between different races. these Nordic peoples all have Aryan language, something we're going to get to tonight, which will prove to be most interesting. Then you find the Mediterranean type, whose original home was in the nations bordering the Mediterranean Sea, and it is still their principal home, though they have spread considerably. You find a fairly substantial Mediterranean-type population in Ireland, for example, quite a few in Britain, quite a few in France. Today, parts of France, parts of England and Ireland, parts of Italy, Spain, Portugal, often in these countries, they are ruled by a Nordic upper crust aristocracy. In general, the Mediterranean peoples have been to a high degree artistic. You will find music, for example, as a characteristic. Not just that they have produced a few musical composers, but that the people in general have a keen appreciation of music. Then there is intermediate in type and in location, the Alpine group. These in general, the Mediterranean, I should mention, they have the long skull. They are generally of darker complexion than the Nordic, and generally of smaller average build. Now, the Alpine are a stocky, thick build as a rule. They have a round skull. They have usually a fair complexion. There are even some of them with blue eyes and blonde hair. You find a considerable number of them among the Russians and among people in some of the Balkan countries. You'll find quite a number of them in Poland, for example. And they are mixed with the Nordics in northern Italy. Most of central France and some of northern Spain has a fair-sized Alpine population. Now, you know, of course, what we have learned of history of the people of Israel. We've studied that so much. But now let's go outside that and take in the Adamic peoples, because they also had a big impact on history. Not quite as much so as the Israelites. But remember, you had the same basic stock until they perished from mongrelization. You had the same basic stock and the same qualities, though not to quite as high a degree as Israel. The first place we pick this up in verifiable history is in northern, and more particularly northwestern India. They left a considerable literature, a great number of epic poems, the Vedas. You know, of course, what Homer's Iliad and Odyssey were, the great epic poems about the Trojan War, and which give us our only record of what life was like among the early Greeks back around 1200-1300 BC. Now, the Vedas, more particularly of them the Rig Veda, cover a period from approximately 2000 BC to approximately 1400 BC. It's a record of the customs, the religion, and the history of the Aryan conquerors of northern India. They call themselves Aryan. The word Arya means noble in Sanskrit. And they did form the nobility, the ruling aristocratic stock, when they conquered northern Italy. Their own writings say they were of fair complexion with narrow, straight, well-bridged noses, and they ridicule the dark peoples they found in India, calling them colored and mentioning they had hardly any nose at all, it was so flat. It records their history, their original point of origin, that they came from a place which is not named, but it was high country, rimmed by tall snow-clad mountains and with rivers, rushing torrents of this melted snow water. They reveal no knowledge of tropical conditions at all. They don't mention rice, for example. They were familiar with the other grains, such as wheat and barley, which they had cultivated. It doesn't show they'd ever heard of rice, which is cultivated so much in northeastern India. It never mentions any of the tropical animals, like the tiger and the elephant and so on. So they came from a place to the north and had migrated a long distance, and they came into India through Afghanistan and the regular invasion route, the Khyber Pass, conquering first the Punjab and in time spreading out over nearly all of northern India, where they set up a kingdom which lasted until, by mongrelization, they lost their ability in about 6 centuries. They left rather extensive writings in this language, Sanskrit, and at first it seemed to be just another one of the dead languages. But finally, scholars digging into it noticed a peculiarity of it. They were finding not only that its grammar was similar to that of the white people's languages, but they began finding hundreds and hundreds of words which were so very similar that it was obvious that the white man's languages had been derived from the Sanskrit. Now, you know that today there are 4 major languages that are derived from Latin: French, Italian, Spanish, and Portuguese. None of them identical with Latin, none of them identical with each other. Their pronunciation is quite different, and even their spelling varies somewhat. And yet, a man who knows any one of these 4 languages could pick up a newspaper printed in one of the other of the 4 and pretty well figure out what it was about, because of the obvious similarities due to the fact that the foundation on which they're all 4 built is Latin. Well, similarly, they were discovering that the Latin itself, as well as Greek and a lot of other languages that we use, was the Sanskrit. As just one example that I happen to remember, in the Sanskrit, the word for father, you might spell in English — they didn't have our alphabet, of course — you might spell it in English as P-A-T-I-R, pater. All right, go on over into Latin and into Greek, pater. Go on into Icelandic, fadir. Into German, vater. They come from an original root in the Sanskrit. And you can multiply those by the hundreds and hundreds and many more hundreds. So these people, these blonde conquerors who came into northern India approximately 2000 BC, were a people so related to us that we're still using later variants of their language. As to where they came from, you might go back to something else. The early part of the book of Genesis describes the Garden of Eden, and it's been difficult to figure where to put it. It says that in the garden, from a lake or headwater there, 4 rivers divided. 2 of them, Gihon and Pishon, are totally impossible to trace. The name is absolutely meaningless. You can't trace it to anything in ancient history or modern, and neither can you find where such a river existed. The other 2, Hiddekel, was the ancient name for what today we call Tigris River, and Phrath was the ancient name for what became Grecianized as Euphrates. If you want to find the headwaters of those, you go up into Armenia, into the mountainous region between the eastern end of the Black Sea and the western side of the Caspian Sea. And there has been, because of the names of these rivers there, generally a tendency, and I'll admit I fell for it myself, to figure that the location of the Garden of Eden must have been someplace up there. But still, geographically, it just won't fit. What are you going to do about those two other rivers? You can't find trace of any ancient river there to say they used to exist and then dried up. They just never were there. Then it dawned upon somebody. From the beginning, our people have been wanderers, always with that wanderlust to go see far places. Getting a little too crowded here. I'm going to move out where there's more elbow room and homestead there. And where we go, we tend to take familiar place names with us. You remember that I have shown you before that in the pass of Israel through the Caucasus Mountains, where some of our Scythian ancestors traveled through there, there's one very prominent peak to which they gave the name of Mount Zion. But you remember Mount Zion was a hill within the limits of the city of Jerusalem, but they took the name along with them. You go to our Atlantic coast, and not only do you find New Jersey and New York, but you go up to Connecticut, and you find the city of New London on the Thames River. But it's not the same Thames River in England that the old London is on. We just took the name along with us. Now, look for a place that will answer it geographically. On the northerly slopes of the Himalaya Mountains near the western end is a big plateau, say roughly 180 miles square, rimmed by mountains 25 to 28,000 feet high, and today uninhabited and uninhabitable because its present altitude is about 15,000 feet and too cold. You couldn't raise anything there to live on. But from a chain of lakes up there, four rivers do spread out in a way that answers the geographical description of the Garden of Eden. And this may well have been it. Now, we know that within what you might call historic times, practically, that some mountain regions had been elevated by great earthquake movement, had been elevated a great deal. Down in the Andes, I am told, you will find places where at the top of a great cliff mountain, you find a portion of a city, and down below, a few thousand feet below at the base of the cliff, you find the rest of the city built down there. In other words, it had been split along a fault line and half of it thrust thousands of feet up into the air. That could be one factor. Also, you know that, of course, they find in Alaska and in Siberia the remains of great tropical forests. In fact, they have dug out of the ice in glaciers in Siberia some of these great mammoth mastodon elephants, which had died so quickly that there remained in their stomachs undigested tropical vegetation. So that the fact that a place is cold today doesn't necessarily mean it always was so. So the Pamir Plateau may very well have been the original Garden of Eden. Incidentally, both Indian, not American Indian, Hindu, and Asiatic legends all point to that region as being the place of origin of mankind, or at least civilization. So there's some old racial memory there that is worthy of note. Now, of course, Adam, after the fall, was driven out of that region. The evidence indicates that he settled in the Tarim Basin, somewhat north of that. That is today part of the Chinese province of Xinjiang, the southwesternmost portion of China, in Xinjiang province are the Chinese atom bomb factories and testing grounds. Now, some of them stayed home around there, and you remember when you come to Noah, you find that the others were killed off because they had mongrelized with the Asiatic population they found surrounding them. Your King James Version, with its extreme effort to become unintelligible, tells you that Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, which is a meaningless phrase if ever you could find one. How can one man have generations in the plural? But you look it up in the Hebrew and it says he was perfect in his ancestry. So, Noah and his family alone had not mongrelized, and the rest who remained in that Tarim Basin, which has plenty of geological evidence to support the idea that that was the location of the flood. The others who remained there had mongrelized, so they had to be destroyed. Noah's flood, of course, was not worldwide, and the Bible never says so. The preachers do. The translators translated it. The flood covered all the world and so forth. The Hebrews said it just covered Eretz, that land. Sure, when you have a flood in the Mississippi Valley, it covers Eretz, that land, not the whole world. Chinese history goes right through the period of Noah's flood without a break. Babylonian history goes right through the same period without a break. And Egyptian history goes right through it without a break. Now, I don't credit these people with being so able that after they were all dead, they continued to write history of this period. So you had a localized flood wiping out some of them. But remember, our people from the beginning have shown this wanderlust, the itching feet to get going. Now, from any place in that region, you would have a land that would answer the description given in the Rig Veda. They came from a high land, not too high to raise crops and that sort of thing, but with enormously high mountains around them, mountains snow-clad all the year, and these great rushing torrents of snow water coming down to form their rivers. So from there, from the home of the Adamic white race, came these blonde Aryans who invaded northern India approximately 2000 BC. Don't be misled by the efforts of Jew professional liars to tell you that Aryan was only a matter of language and had nothing to do with race. The people who used it never used it in regard to language, they used it only in regard to race. The word Arya meant noble, and they called themselves Aryan or noble. Now, they had come into a place where in South India, to which they probably never penetrated, southern half, you had the utterly negroid Dravidians. But in North India, there had been an earlier invasion of a white race. The only real civilization in India, other than that brought by these Aryans, had evolved in northern India. And their description of the people they found shows that those who were there when the Aryans came were not the pure black Negro Dravidians, but they were a mongrel mulatto race. They'd had a pretty high culture. You remember reading in the last few years of the archaeologists digging up the long-forgotten city of Mohenjo-Daro, for example. Now, there was a brick city. The remains we find of the cities in the Babylonian and Assyrian Empire in the Tigris-Euphrates valleys were laid out with no science at all. Their streets were wandering cow paths, narrow, crooked, But here in Mohenjo-Daro, you have a modern street grid laid out at right angles, north, south, east, west. A well-built brick city with tremendous brick fortification walls and towers around it. So that, as originally created, it was the product of people with tremendous energy and good engineering skill. But wherever you find, and this is the invariable lesson of history, wherever you find two very different races in contact, mongrelization, and thereby the destruction of a higher type, always comes. So by the time these Aryans came in, there were people living in Mohenjo-Daro, a beautiful fortification, and they no longer had the courage and the determination and the character to defend it. And they were easily overrun and conquered. Well, the lesson was not lost on the Aryans. They had a fierce race pride because they realized only their racial characteristics were what gave them power. And they were determined not to perish by mongrelization the way this earlier white race, which they overran, had perished. Perished, as I say, as a white race, because what was left were mulattoes. You will find Hindus today who have the white man's mold of feature, but they're black as my shoes if it comes to complexion. Black as any Negro you'd ever meet. And you know what India has been as far back as any recorded history goes, nothing but the cesspool of the earth. As they mongrelized with these Dravidian Negroes, they became what any mulatto always becomes. He can't create anything new. He can't even keep up the standard what his white ancestors had originally developed. So these Aryans set up a rigid system of caste. They had among themselves four castes: warriors, priests, a third caste with farmers and merchants, and finally the fourth caste with laborers. Now the upper castes rather looked down a little on the others as being not quite their equal, though they were still of the Aryan race. But now the people they found living there that they conquered in India, they didn't even honor them to the extent of creating the fifth caste for them. They were outcasts. Rigid laws against any intermarriage or race mixing were enacted, and in fact you were not supposed to marry outside of your caste. You had, even among the whites, an aristocracy among the whites, and they wanted to preserve it. And after a time, caste finally became hereditary among them, although at the very start, this was not so. But remember, anybody who would have intercourse with a Negro is the scum and filth of the white race anyway, and very probably about the same part of the Negro race, too. Those who have any pride of race of their own, on either side, look down upon mixing. Now, such children as, in spite of their law against it, no marriage was allowed, but there was mixing outside of marriage. And the resultant mongrel children were not allowed to live within any city where the Aryan peoples were. Both races utterly despised them. The Aryan soldiery were authorized to kill them on sight for most any cause, but just the same, it went on. The mixing of the scum of both races, so that your mongrel is a mixture of the worst of both races. Well, what happened? First you have mulattoes, and then pretty soon you have quadroons, one quarter black, three quarters white. And then pretty soon you have the octoroons, who are 7/8 white and one quarter negro. And some of them good looking, some of them light complected enough to pass as rather a dark complected white man, and some of them do and get away with it. And all this time you have the sob sister type, oh, these poor people, we mustn't discriminate against them. Why, they would like to marry a white woman, same as anybody else. Why shouldn't we allow them to do it? Why should we discriminate, and so on? And as I say, the lighter they get, the stronger this pressure is. Well, in the course of six centuries, nature took its course. The highest civilization that India knew was brought in there by these Aryans, and it crumbled in six centuries as a result of mongrelization. These Aryans who went in there had a fairly high religion. No, it wasn't ours, but at least they had but one god, whom they called Indra. And they despised and utterly looked down upon the low animal worship of the Hindus among whom they were. Now they had one peculiar thing in here, which may be a racial memory of something. There are a lot of these legends, you know, that creep up and you only find them after the poets have worked on them for a bit, but the poet had to get his idea from someplace. And some of these race memories that crop up centuries later are interesting to trace back to their source. They said that their god Indra had been incarnated at the time of the invasion as a man, as a warrior leader, to be their leader and take them into this new land of northwestern India. He was a big, powerful man, hard-drinking, hard-fighting, like the rest of their warriors, with tawny beard, light complexion, blue eyes, a fierce warrior. Now, before you condemn that as utter paganism, remember this. Your Bible records a number of instances where God appeared in the form of a man. You remember, for example, Abraham was sitting at the door of his tent a few hours' journey away from the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and three men came along, and Abraham, following the Oriental custom of hospitality, greeted them, asked them to stop, and he would prepare food for them, refresh themselves before they went on. They told him they were going down to Sodom to see if it was as bad as it had been reported, and if so, to destroy it. Now you go back and read that passage in your book of Genesis, and one of them unmistakably speaks not as an angel, as God. He talks about what he is going to do to Sodom there, and Abraham recognizes who it is. You remember he speaks up and he says, but there might be 50 decent people in the city. Would you destroy the whole city and leave 50 people along with them because the rest of them are bad? And God said, no. If I find 50 people there, I'll spare it. Well, Abraham was still worried. He had better things to worry about. But remember, stupidity is our one most outstanding characteristic. We worry about the wrong thing. Well, maybe there aren't 50, but perhaps there are only 40. Wouldn't you spare the city for 40? God said, yes, if I can find even 40, I'd spare it. And Abraham keeps arguing, trying to get the city out of its trouble, and finally he gets worried. He said, here I've been arguing with God himself over this. And this same one of the three men, you remember, he says, now, why should I hide from Abraham the thing that I am going to do? I know him, his character. I know he's going to bring up his children right after him, so they will follow according to my commandments. And I am going to make of Abraham a great nation, and so on. Bible tells you that was God in human form. And you will find several other instances of that sort. Now, it couldn't, of course, have been any race memory of the time when God appeared in human form as Jesus Christ, because remember, this was 2,000 years before Christ. But just the same, perhaps there is a little of this race memory coming in here. One may say that God appeared to be their leader. Remember now, he didn't make himself in human form. He appeared as this tremendous column of fire by night and cloud by day to lead his people out of Egypt and into Palestine. So maybe they have some old race memory as a foundation for saying that their god Indra, God incarnated in human form, was their leader.